I think perfect health in your body, what I'd like to call yoga, where every cell of the body trusts every other cell. I call it my yoga practice, but I practice being relaxed. And then when potential boredom or stress hits me in my life, I'm not bored, I'm not stressed. I have freedom. Freedom to choose. Once you master it and recognize that happiness is purely a choice that the conscious mind can make at any moment, regardless of the stress around you, then you override everything else. The perceived environment is different to the real environment. Our real environmental stimulus is not what we're actually seeing on the outside, but how our body interprets it. The easiest way to feel happy is if you can make your perceived environment a nice one. If everyone did this, I believe the world would be a better place, but it has to start within yourself. People are trying to approach exercise, relaxation, and meditation, but there's a discontinuity. The exercise gives limited benefits to blood flow, but with stress. And the meditation give limited benefits to relaxation without making blood flow. And what we really want is enhanced blood flow. And when someone has good energy and loving information flowing through themselves, being shared between all the cells, it just makes them have this really good internal feeling of trust in themselves and a sense of love within themselves. And it just makes them want to share it with the first person they meet. We need something which can help people who are stressed and depressed, or both, or either. We need something which is going to help people who are physically weak and no energy, and also the ones who are very, very strong as well. Something that can bridge all of it.
So you just heard Simon Borg-Olivier, who for over 50 years has been a practitioner of traditional energy practices and mental control, which some people might associate with meditation, pranayama, yoga. So that's a pretty long time practicing. But get this, he's also a research scientist, starting off in microbiology and eventually becoming a university lecturer, a physiotherapist for 25 years. But he's also taken a lot of information from teachers who are pan-global, teachers from many traditions, including indigenous traditions from the place where he was mainly raised, Australia, but predominantly Tibet, Japan, India and China. And of course, yoga is an Indian tradition, and studied with some absolute masters of the 20th century, including BKS Iyengar and others who you'll know, and also studied with people that you wouldn't know so well, such as Professor Bim Dev and Simon's current teacher, Master Chuenhua Yang. Simon's a university lecturer in RMIT in Melbourne. He published, co-authored with Bianca Matchless, probably the most in-depth and to this day groundbreaking book, The Applied Anatomy and Physiology of Yoga. As well as the book, Simon's authored many scientific articles, been involved in other well-known yoga publications in the last half century, and of course co-founded one of Australia's most respected and oldest yoga schools, Yoga Synergy. Thank you. I'm so glad you tuned into this podcast. It's going to give you some insights into how you can regulate your body and mind just so easily by listening to somebody who's been doing it a lot for many, many years. There's a couple of millennia's generations worth of wisdom in this podcast, and it's brought to you in a fairly understandable language. In this conversation, we talk about demystifying the nervous system insofar as taking some well-known theories and really picking them apart and trying to find a rounder perspective than the simple binaries. We talked about links between the brainwave state of meditators and those undergoing psychedelic experience and a little bit of the research around that. We talk about the pitfalls of how exercise can induce or enhance imbalanced states such as depression or stress. And this is leading Simon to develop his system called five-dimensional flow. You can find more information about Simon on his website, simonborgolivier.com. So I'll put a link in the show notes too. I'd encourage you to explore more, especially if it's the first time you've heard of Simon's work in this podcast. What I really wanted to do in this conversation was to talk about some topics that I hadn't heard after listening to so many of his talks throughout time. So I hope that this conversation is a really interesting one for you, where we dial in a little bit deeper into that link between the physiology and the mental states. And importantly, the relationship between them as a guide to understanding ourselves in body, energy, and mind. So what insights in this podcast? Well, it's a lot about the core and the misunderstandings of the core that have come about from the more reductive Western model of exercise, fitness, health, and wellness that separated parts. And we talk about a holistic methodology which has been used for thousands of years and how you can access, even without any practice and experience, just the knowledge in this podcast will give you the insights, and hopefully it'll be quite a revelation for you to hear what we have to talk about. And what I love about this man is he's quite humble, considering his absolute dedication to the arts, the internal arts of yoga and meditation and pranayama. His unwavering commitment and lack of sleep, showing that his energy is, he actually practices what he preaches, and he's able to cultivate this incredible knowledge and wisdom, and just embodies and imbues and shares the love that he dedicates his life to. So Simon, it's really nice to speak to you officially as well as personally. It's been a little while since we've caught up.
Stefan, it's a pleasure.
I'm so honoured that you could join me for this conversation, the very first of the Core Flow podcast, in which I'm going to be interviewing a lot of different synergy teachers of the approach. And I'm sure you'll talk on this a little bit more, but the approach is, of course, a method that can be applied to various different kinds of movement, and it's not necessarily just a yoga style. So it'd be great to hear a little bit about that from you. And I'm also going to be sharing a bunch of resources so that people can listen to lots of other talks and podcasts that you've done where you cover such a broad range of topics. And one of them, which was really nice, was a sort of overview of your experience on the Just Breathe podcast, where you talk about all your different teachers, including your very first yoga teacher, as it were, who taught you the benders, Basil Brown, the South African athlete, and of course your father, who is your original pranayama teacher, who taught you to swim underwater because your bones were so heavy that you had to swim underwater. It's a really fun story. So I'm going to love to point people to all of your history. So we've got that covered. You talk a lot in your other talks about carbon dioxide and the importance of moving functionally. So I'd like to focus with you on a few different topics, such as the nervous system and your research on traditional yogic energy, if you're willing to talk about those topics. And then I'd love to have just a back and forth with you and to share this wonderful space of connection, and as well just to preempt your self-introduction by saying thank you so much for everything that you offer this world and the beauty that you offer it, and personally how transformative it's been for me, and how affirming and how efficient it's been that you've brought so many of the sporadic teachings that are found across here, there and everywhere of yoga, and you seem to have such a beautiful literacy and a clarity about the way you deliver it. So yeah, that was a bit of a bigger introduction than I'd planned, but I hope that all lands well with you. And I'd just like to start by asking, how are you feeling today?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Stefan. Thank you very much for inviting me. And also thank you so much for your passion. And you know, we've known each other for quite a few years now, and I've seen you go from strength in the beginning to strength, more strength all the way through. And you've been a wonderful advocate of what you're doing, and you've really, you know, taken the time to explore it and develop it and understand it, which is just to me so heartwarming. And it's my privilege and my pleasure and my honor to be here to, you know, share whatever I can with whatever you'd like to ask me. I'm really happy to be here, actually.
Thank you. So I'm glad you're feeling the happiness and the reverence as well. Thanks for celebrating me. It's such an honor. The nervous system. And I'd really like to hear what you have to say about how the nervous system intersects with our mental and emotional state. And do you have any interest in the work of Gabor Maté, for instance, to do with trauma? Because there's a huge world of trauma literacy opening up and lots of really interesting studies coming around as well. So first question is, how is your feeling towards the nervous system?
Okay, this is very interesting. I mean, I think Gabor Maté is one of the ones who talked about the Porges, I think, who was talking about the vagus nerve and its potential role as a sympathetic nervous system portion. All of that stuff is very, very interesting, and I'm, you know, trying to follow all the research with all of that. But if we go down to basic levels, then if I had to explain the nervous system at a simplistic level, I often say to people, and I choose simplistic levels because sometimes it's the easiest way to look at things. Often we get into too much technical detail. And what's that expression? Can't see the forest for the trees. So the way I look at it is that the nervous system is our system for the transport of information through the body. And that nervous system consists of two main parts. One is the conscious part, and the other part's the unconscious part. So the conscious part we call somatic nervous system. The other part we call unconscious, or some people call it subconscious. I have these arguments with people, but it's basically what we call technically the autonomic nervous system, where subconscious and conscious mind intersect. These maybe other issues as well. But if we look at it simplistically, conscious and unconscious mind relate to the somatic and autonomic nervous system. We think of the somatic nervous system as being that part of the nervous system where we have voluntary control over what we instruct our body to do. And we think of the autonomic nervous system as being that part where we have automatic control. Autonomic and automatic we could use synonymously. And the autonomic nervous system is loosely divided into three main parts. Now, as we understand the nervous system more, there are all these overlaps which people like Gabor Maté and Stephen Porges talk about. But if we look at the three main parts of the autonomic or automatic nervous system, we have the sympathetic nervous system. I say that first because it's the one that most people know of, and the euphemistic name, colloquial name of the sympathetic nervous system is the flight or fight response. Then we have the parasympathetic nervous system, which is popularly called the relaxation response. And I like to use a few extra words. I like to call the sympathetic nervous system the flight, fight, freeze, and fear response. And I like to call the parasympathetic nervous system the rest, relaxation, rejuvenation, and regeneration mode. So the four Fs and the four Rs. And the sympathetic nervous system tends to be stimulated and tends to have a dominance when you facing a potential threat. And I remember reading in, you know, high school textbooks and often used in university textbooks, they talked about a primitive nervous system when a primitive cave person would meet a saber-toothed tiger. And when the saber-toothed tiger approaches you, you would then, you know, want to either run for your life or have to face the tiger who's attacking you and fight it. So hence it was called the, you know, the flight or fight response. And of course, there are no saber-toothed tigers now, but what we have is, you know, saber-toothed children. If you're a family person, you have saber-toothed relationships, saber-toothed banks and saber-toothed mortgages over your head. And so these are the things that we react to in terms of flight or fight. And when you're in a state of flight or fight, assuming it was this primitive response, because you're trying to run away from something or you're trying to fight something, you put all your efforts into the muscles of running away and fighting. And that means you put less effort energetically and in terms of blood flow to things like your internal organs. And, you know, fighting takes a lot of energy. Running away takes a lot of energy. So you take off the emphasis of using energy for the digestive system or the reproductive system or the immune system, and you put it all into fighting or running away. Conversely, if you have a dominance of the parasympathetic nervous system, that's the nervous system that should be dominating most of the time if you're in a healthy state, that will tend to be where you feel safe and that you're more likely to have the adequate functioning of your immune system, digestive system, reproductive system. And so in those times, then your body is experiencing safety, trust, well-being, you know, a sense of contentedness around the, you know, no threat. There's no threat, so the body can stay in parasympathetic dominance. When there is a threat to the body, the sympathetic nervous system dominates, and the dominant emotions will be fear, anger, aggression, lack of safety, lack of trust. And what we want really is to have most of the time, for healthy bodies, the parasympathetic nervous system should dominate over the sympathetic. It's not that you turn off your sympathetic nervous system. It's more a little bit like the analogy I like is the one of the stereo player where you're playing music and you have a treble control and a bass control. And it's not like you turn up treble and bass goes down, or you turn up bass and treble goes down. It's sometimes you have treble and bass high, or bass and treble low, or one high, one low. You can oscillate them. So what we really want is a certain level of sympathetic and a certain level of parasympathetic, but you can't let the parasympathetic drop too much. Otherwise, you get this dominance of this flight or fight response, which you get the fear, anger, aggression, lack of safety, lack of trust, which doesn't sound like yoga. I mean, if the principle of yoga is to recognize we're all connected as one, then you should be able to trust the one you're connected with, and that doesn't sound like yoga if you're having this. So I think perfect health in your body is a state of what I'd like to call yoga, where every cell of the body trusts every other cell, and every cell of the body can share good energy and loving information with each other. In which case, if you want to stay healthy, you want parasympathetic dominance. But when we look at the balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic, you're looking at the relation to the cardiovascular system, and the cardiovascular system responds to sympathetic, parasympathetic with heart rate, for example. So when your heart rate increases, it's more sympathetic. When your heart rate decreases, it's less sympathetic, more parasympathetic. So a healthy heart rate has variability. If someone is very healthy, they'll notice that on inhalation, heart rate goes up, and on exhalation, heart rate goes down. And the difference between the rate of the heart, you know, over the space of a minute is called heart rate variability. Ideally, it shifts with the breath, but breath must not be overforced to do this. I had a friend who lost all his sympathetic tone, and he was a martial artist, a very good Aikido practitioner. And you'd almost think that if you lose your sympathetic tone, everything's going to be fantastic. You'll just be peaceful and calm. But what happened was his heart rate dropped way too low, and they had to put a pacemaker into him, and he was 34, 35 years old. And this, of course, changed his life. And I'm hoping he's okay now. But still, if you've got a pacemaker installed into your body, that is very restrictive. I don't think you can drive cars.
Yeah. And it brings up a really interesting point that I want to kind of come back to a few things which you've raised here. And the first one is the freeze response. And then the thing I'd like to go to immediately is this is like we need to remember that these are just symbolic systems to recognize, you know, there isn't although there is circuitry, and I'd like to hear more on this from you about the nerves and how they move in the body without getting too interested in the trees and missing the forest. But actually to talk about how the system relates to our movement. And you mentioned your friend had lost sympathetic tone. This is another quite well-established scientific study about sympathetic toning and its importance in health as well. So you're talking about the dominance of parasympathetic, for those who need a reminder, which is the rest, restore, regenerate system that you refer to. But of course, that we have to move as well, you know. So it's really important that we have movement, but in order to regulate it, how do we do that efficiently? And you're talking about one of the markers of that is having good heart rate variability.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's very important. And so when I say, in other words, that what we're looking for is parasympathetic dominance, it has to be parasympathetic dominance with a healthy heart rate variability, where essentially the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system are oscillating. One goes up, one goes down, but the overall dominance is parasympathetic. But you do need some sympathetic tone. That was my point, essentially. The other part of the autonomic or automatic nervous system is called the enteric nervous system, and it's often forgotten. The enteric nervous system is also known as the gut brain. And the enteric nervous system is a large plexus or network of nerves that is essentially in the region between the navel and the pubic bone, between the sacrum and the pubic bone, between the diaphragm and the pelvic floor. It's inside there, and it's wrapped around the intestines, and it's interspersed with the tissues of the immune system, reproductive system, digestive system, essentially. But what they have realized is that all action in the body really has to go from the thinking brain in our head via this, what we can call an action brain in the core, the gut brain, the enteric nervous system, and then to the rest of the body. And if anything you do bypasses the gut brain, it's just not as efficient. It's possible, but it's not as efficient. We first realized that in the West in the 1990s, late 80s, early 90s, when Australian physiotherapists recognized that if someone has got a lower back problem compared to someone who has not got a lower back problem.
Yeah, they did that study where the movement from the core first means that healthier movement will occur as a result of that moving the core first.
Yes.
In that 90s study, right?
Yes, yeah.
So you think as well as musculoskeletally, that was actually alluding to the enteric system as well,
yes,
whether it
yes.
was mentioned in the study or not.
Yes, yeah. The idea that people with healthy backs, it was not about having a stronger core, it's just whether they initiated their movement from the core. And somehow that was lost. Those early studies on the on what we can call now the core were misunderstood. It reflected the ideas that a healthy person would draw their navel, their lower abdomen, in toward their spine just before movement. But they didn't specify how. But what it did say was that basically the core would somehow engage before movement of the arms or legs. And this research was a little bit misunderstood, I believe. And it sent people off on a funny
Bounds
track.
It.
But
it seems a lot of people took this sort of superficial, like, what does that look like on the surface thing, and made that the underlying momentum, whereas actually there's a lot more complexity. And just to go back to what you said, not seeing the wood for the trees or the forest for the trees, I just want to acknowledge and celebrate the yogic wisdom in that, because these sort of traditional systems of, you know, you look a lot at Chinese energy as well as the Indian systems, they're very holistic. You know, we're looking at the forest, you know, we need to step back and look at the forest rather than be too interested in this reductive approach that, you know, you yourself have studied so much. It's so important to understand the Western approach and the reductive approach, in that it, you know, we see the details and we have measures and we have studies and science, and, you know, we can look at things on that level and it's useful. However, like, I really appreciate that you took us back to the forest. And you said about, look, we're observing the whole here. And maybe this study from Australian physiotherapists in the 80s, 90s was kind of looking at the forest, but everyone looked at the trees in that forest and said, move the core first, pull the core in, or stabilize the core. And, you know, you said that study exploded, and people took it at that level, at the simplistic level, quite a lot, to some extent, where it's still taught for people to pull the navel into the spine in order to stabilize it. However, that might not necessarily work as well in movement. And also the rest of the forest in this story, you know, the core is the one of the trees, but the rest of the forest, is it not the enteric nervous system, the effect on the rest of the rest and digest, fight and flight systems, and also the hormones in the rest of the body and the neurochemicals, you know, like actually that movement from the core, it's not just, would you agree that it's not just, its importance is not just mechanical, and would you like to expand on that?
This movement from the core is not just mechanical. I think a lot of people think that when you start talking about working with the core, it's always about hardening the core. Probably maybe only a quarter to a fifth of the movements that I do from my core will actually cause the core to harden. And the less I can make my core harden, the better effect I get. Where there's a necessity for hardness, you take it. But generally, the harder the core gets, and the more the muscles tense there, the more you block blood flow, the more you lock the spine, and the more energy it wastes. So if you can achieve the same effect with less muscle work, you get a better result in terms of conserving energy and also moving energy through the body. So that's where I say it's not as mechanical as people think. That's what I think that's one way of looking at it. The same is true.
And mentally.
And mentally, it's not as challenging either, yeah. But the other thing, of course, is not just movement should start from the core, but also breathing should start from the core. And a lot of people have lost this. You know, natural breathing is the breath that you feel when you use your diaphragm as the primary and main mode of breathing. And, you know, if someone were to breathe purely in a diaphragmatic fashion, you don't see the ribs move at all. In fact, if the ribs, a lot of people will teach that when you breathe diaphragmatically, you should hold your lower ribs, and as you inhale, you'll feel the ribs move outwards. But the diaphragm is a muscle that goes from one rib, you know, one side of the ribs to the other side of the ribs. So if muscles contract when they become active or try and contract, they should pull the rib cage inwards, not outwards. So I feel that when people are teaching and practicing, make the ribs expand outwards on inhalation, that's not purely a diaphragmatic breath. The diaphragm may be becoming active, but to a certain extent, it's being inhibited. So what I'm suggesting is that
because the cantilever shape, it's like a parachute shape, isn't it?
Something like this.
When the diaphragm is breathing in, it's pulling down, which you're implying would pull the ribs in rather than expand them out.
Yes. But you've heard many people teach that let's do a diaphragmatic breath by put your hands on your lower ribs and move the ribs outwards.
Yeah, I've not heard that one so much. But I think talking about the lower ribs is something, that I've heard a bunch.
They talk about the lower ribs moving outwards on inhalation, but really it's the opposite. The lower ribs will pull inwards. And I've been practicing breath control for more than 50 years, and I can make my diaphragm descend downwards and upwards, and I can control it whether air comes in or out. And these things I've seen on real-time ultrasound and some of the experiments that I've done.
Amazing. I've
played a lot with real-time ultrasound.
I'm really interested in this idea of the awareness from the core as well, you know, that it's not even just a musculoskeletal thing. It's not even just a nervous system entity. Enteric nervous system thing. It's not even just a breathing thing, but also might it be a mental thing as well, because you talk a lot about moving from the core, and that's to say moving the awareness, you know, less from this third eye brain center, if you like, down into the what you call the khanda, which is referred to as the secret space in between the Shvadhisthana and the
It's Manipura and Svadhisthana. So the abdominal center, Manipura chakra, and the pubic center, sometimes they call it sexual center, that's Svadhisthana. And so they say that in Indian yoga, the khanda is the origin of 72,000 nadis, and nadis are subtle channels. And that is what they call the khanda. But it's pretty much analogous to what in China they call the Dantian, in Korea they call Dandon, I think. In the stories from Japan, they talk about the hara as being the abdominal center, but at the center of the hara they call it the Tanden. And in certain indigenous cultures in Australia, they have the name Nadu Kuru, which is this same thing as the khanda, which really I'm seeing as the enteric nervous system. But it's not just the nerves. I mean, when you think about it, the divisions that the Western anatomist, you know, physiologist has put, they're very, very arbitrary divisions. I mean, how do you divide the nervous system from the cardiovascular system when a lot of the molecules of the nervous system travel through the cardiovascular system as neurotransmitters? And, you know, how do you subdivide the endocrine system with the nervous system when molecules which we call neurotransmitters in one part of the body, the same molecules called a hormone in another part of the body? So we find that actually all the different organ systems interact with each other. And that's why, you know, we could talk at length about the science behind the nervous system, but really it's not really fully understood. And there are many weird bits. And if I could just digress a little bit further and go, so what are we talking about? If we're talking about the conscious nervous system, somatic nervous system, and the unconscious nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, which consists of sympathetic, parasympathetic, and enteric, which are sympathetic flight or fight response, parasympathetic relaxation response, and the enteric nervous system, the core, and the idea that all movement, all breath should come from the core, and we should basically act from our core, think from our core, breathe from our core, move from our core, feel from our core, our gut feeling. That's when you work best. Then what are we looking at when we start doing things to make us healthier? What do we look at when we start doing things that make us less healthy? And for example, when we're talking about the best, healthiest states, we could be talking about meditation. And so when I look at meditation, for example, then on a mental level, what we're looking at is something which is engaging in a way that your mind is happily in that place of the activity that you're doing, to the point that it is in the present moment and it is engaged in the activity. That idea has been, you know, studied a little bit, especially in the studies of psychedelics in the last 10 to 15 years. They realized that many psychedelic substances like LSD, you know, lysergic acid, diethyl amide, and other psychedelics were causing a very particular brainwave and brain state pattern, which they said cause the default network of the brain to switch off. And the default network of the brain is that place where we have time traveling and ego. So when they found the people who they studied on psychedelics in the last 10 years, because before that, psychedelic research was not legal for about 30 or 40 years. It's only become legal again in the last 10 and or so, and they've been doing it at places like Johns Hopkins University. They noticed that the people on the psychedelic drugs were in a place where their time-traveling center turned off and their ego center turned off, so they felt like they were in a place where they were totally engaged in the present moment and in the activity they were doing. And the studies facilitators, the scientists who did this work, said this was a completely unique brainwave pattern which they've only ever seen in one other place, and that was in profound and proficient meditators. So it seems like this research inadvertently led us to understand that meditation on a neurobiological level is really akin to the state that we get when we're under psychedelic drugs, at least temporarily, which is a place where you no longer travel into the future or past. You're really in the present moment, and you're no longer feeling this problem of separation. You feel connected. And this feeling of being here and now, that's really a really good state for people to be in. And, you know, I remember my first Japanese teacher, he actually wrote that in my book, when he signed my book, and that when I looked at the text, it actually said, be here now. And it really is the definition of meditation. And often what they talk about with meditation, which could be samadhi, it could be nirvana, depending on, you know, what place, what's it called, the Japanese one, satori, you know, like this. And this place is a place where they say the subject and the object have become one. And so if you're perhaps if you're a master meditator, you could, for example, look at a tree and meditate on the tree and become one with the tree. But it's not an easy thing to do. It's really quite challenging to imagine yourself really unifying with the tree because it's an external thing to your body.
Well, you might say it's impossible to imagine.
It's like some people can do it. For me, it's not as easy to do. For most people, it would not be easy to do. But how much easier would it be to take your thinking brain and really connect with your action brain? So you make the brain that's in your head connect with the what we call a second brain in your core. And when every movement you make gets connected straight to your core before your limbs. Every breath you make doesn't come through your nose, but it starts at your core. Every feeling you make, you feel it from your core. And then you could really more realistically say, subject, your head brain, and object, your core brain, your enteric nervous system, are much more connected as one. And the thing is, that would be a way then of really getting the meditative state into someone if you can move from the core, act from the core, think from the core. And I believe this is what animals do. I believe this is what elite athletes do. And I think you can train people to do this much more. And when you look at things like trauma and like other psychological issues such as depression and stress, sometimes they say that depression is too much dwelling in the past, and stress sometimes is too much dwelling into a potential future. And so if you get someone who's depressed or stressed, you just get them to be here now, the stress and depression tends to go away. Very few people actually have just stress or just depression. Most people will have a bit of stress and a bit of depression coming at different times. So what we want to help with depression is to make things more interesting. What we need to help with stress is to make things more calming. So what can make something more interesting could be stimulating the nervous system. But if you do that to someone who's stressed, you could irritate them. So that's only going to work if someone is purely depressive. And like I said, most people will have a bit of depression and a bit of stress. And when someone has really got chronic depression and stress at the same time, that could be an interpretation of trauma. Another interpretation of trauma could be that if you put someone into a place which could be, for maybe you and I, a meditative space, something which we excite ourselves with a little bit, but don't excite ourselves too much that it becomes stressful, and something which calms us a little bit, but don't calm us so much that it becomes boring. If we can get engaged in an interesting, calming activity, that could put us in a meditative state. But if you step up the engagement, if you step up the interest, you know, if you make someone, for example, do too many activities at once, it becomes too stressful. Then they lose the excitement, it becomes stress. If you take away too much stimulation and you make someone calm down too much, it can become very boring. So I think freedom, which is something we all look for, liberation, is the ability to do as much as possible without getting stuck. So one expression of yoga or meditation for me has always been, how much stress can you take while feeling relaxed, and how much boredom can you take, or how much calmness can you take without being bored? And for some people, I think what they're living in is in a very, very narrow space. That space between boredom and stress is so tiny that they're no longer free in their mind. You know, if you can tolerate boredom, no problems at all, you'll always feel just relaxed. If you can tolerate stress, at best you'll feel excited. But many people have a very short gap between boredom and stress. So what we want is to make that as big as possible. But there are some people who I believe are actually those lines have crossed over. So as soon as they, you know, already they're bored and stressed at the same time. And for those people, that could be an expression of trauma.
So interference crossed over rather than sort of dancing together, you're saying?
Yes, yes. And this is a little bit where they talk about this idea of flight, fight, and freeze response. So,
and I wanted to pick up on that as well.
Yeah.
May I jump in a second?
Yes, yes, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, because Porges, you mentioned earlier in the context of trauma, Stephen Porges, one of the main proponents of the theory, again, it's another concept, conceptual measure and stick, if you like, of how fight and flight works and how freeze comes into it. Well, you alluded to fight and flight and freeze in the same Fs. It works with the alliteration. However, Porges will actually say that it's a branch of the parasympathetic nervous system where freeze occurs. And it's not necessarily that it exists on that branch, but it's just where you fall off of the sympathetic branch on. So really high stimulation actually takes us out of the sympathetic branch of the nervous system and drops us deep, almost beyond control in the sort of freeze response is like a hyper parasympathetic state, right? Because the heart rate slows, it's playing dead.
Yes.
You know, and that is not a sympathetic state. That's a parasympathetic state. So there's that.
One would presume, yes, yeah. I mean, that's what the theory says. But really, maybe that just reflects the arbitrary subdivision, this reductionist view that the Western mind tends to have on all things. This idea that we are all separated. I mean, because the art of yoga really is, you know, to recognize that everything is connected as one.
Yeah.
But maybe that's an arbitrary state as well, because really one of the big dilemmas in yoga and philosophy is the idea that there is this ongoing question as to whether we live in a world of duality or non-duality. And they call this Dvaita and Advaita in yoga.
Yeah.
So where this idea of duality says that we are all separate in one way, and the idea of non-duality says we're not separate, we're all connected. And really, to think that one is correct and the other is incorrect is a fallacy in a way, and it would not lead to a very good result. And the way I try and explain this to my students sometimes is by saying that, imagine, you know, if I was like a dictator of a large country and I said, look, you know, we're all connected as one, you know, and I can feel your energies and I love you all. And because I love you all so much, I'm going to collect all the nicest foods in the country and I'm going to eat them all. But because we are connected, you will experience the joy of that food through me because I'm connected with you. Well, of course, this could come across as being very, very selfish. You know, me thinking I'm connected with you could mean also that I think, well, look, you know, maybe you're not quite as important to hang on to, but it's okay. You will live on through me.
You know, someone so we kind of talk into an embodiment there, and also the social engagement system. So yes. Porges, again, Stephen Porges talks about, you know, the kind of height of our balance, you know, can be this socially engaged system where we're connecting with the eyes and with the movements of the body, but that we are actually socially engaged and socially engaged creatures. We're pack animals rather than, you know, these sort of individual birds of prey, as it were. So you're sort of alluding there a little bit to like, I really appreciate that you've brought this in actually, because there is for me actually such a danger in that Advaita, in that non-duality idea, if somebody's not embodied and if somebody's not connected to their heart, to their gut, to their community, then they could very easily intellectualize, you know, a oneness philosophy and at the damage and at the disconnection, at the state of disconnection. And I think a lot of the classical yogas were interested in that, you know, go off to a cave, have your enlightenment, go be one with the tree, and then, you know, it's a great experience and you'll experience the ultimate awareness of consciousness. And you do. However, there's something remarkably profound about the fact that people always were interested in those people, in those renunciates and those monks. And they were like, well, what is it? You know, like, so there was a social engagement happening there, even though it wasn't present at the time. And I think the system that you're offering us in terms of connecting to the core, connecting to our guts, which, you know, means we have to go through our heart, is helping us to reconnect as one in community and as people. For instance, like the way you teach without words, you know, there's no words interfering in that sort of process of connection. And I've had experiences practicing with you where I didn't see Simon anymore. I saw this sort of like yogic sort of deity thing in front of me. And I'm like, you know, when you drop into your practice, it's so profound for me to see that and to practice with you. So I offer a lot of my classes like that, and people get the effect of being present and being embodied, and they can really connect to the course so much easily without the words being an interference to that.
Well, that's a whole separate session. All the stuff you've talked about, then it relates to left brain and right brain. And left brain sometimes is associated with the sympathetic nervous system, right brain associated with the parasympathetic nervous system. Left brain is associated with the intellectualizing and, you know, using words to instruct, for example, which I do use sometimes. But then I'll usually finish each session by teaching people with visual stimulus primarily. And then they can actually feel it more with their right brain, which is more of an intuitive brain. And the balance between them is good. And what we want, of course, is an integrated brain. And if you like, in one way, we could think of the left brain as being a dualistic brain and the right brain being a non-dualistic brain. The right brain feels connection in the present moment. It feels a sense of oneness, and the left brain recognizes there's a disconnection. Because what I was going to say was that, you know, if I was this almighty dictator of one country and I just said, look, we're all connected as one and I'm having all the food, you can experience it through me, people could consider themselves a little bit ripped off, you know. But if I go, look, I recognize that I live in a dualistic world and that I have to acknowledge that other people have their needs, and I should recognize their needs and I should share and actually acknowledge them to be individuals, then I think I get a more balanced response. So the idea that we have both dual and non-dual existing at the same time is important. And the idea we have sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system existing at the same time, and they're not two separate systems, they're actually very much interconnected. Mm. So it does seem like sometimes that we have this flight or fight response, and which becomes flight, fight, or suddenly freeze. Is freeze then part of sympathetic or parasympathetic? That's just an artificial construct. You know, it looks parasympathetic, but of course, it still is part of the sympathetic. It's part of the artificial nature of what we're actually describing. Very interesting stuff, you know, fascinating. Mm. I find it really, really exciting.
Yeah, it's the kind of cohesion between, isn't it? Mm. And I'm really interested in this idea that the Kundalini might actually be an allusion towards that which you've been pointing to as well, in this not one nor the other, but actually a balance between what the so-called parasympathetic and sympathetic branches in response to the need of the self or the other. Well, let's close the first part there. We started with a very brief idea of the nervous system and found our way all the way to the center, the kanda, this esoteric place, this origin of 72,000 subtle channels, the nadis. So nice to go into how this central point of the body is also a significant central point of the mind and the energy of the body. We'll expand upon this in the second part, where Simon talks about how he synthesized this into a system of movement and breathing and mental control, which leads to this place of just naturally feeling good. And it's actually really simple as well. So from the complex, when we bring it into the center, we find simplicity. I really hope you can join for that second really expansive, revelatory second part coming up. Welcome back to the second part with Simon Borg-Olivier, co-founder of the Synergy School and Style, and for your listening pleasure, for your delight, and for your insight. And in the second part with Simon, we talk about, well, feeling good, and what are the mechanics, what are the simple nuts and bolts behind feeling good? Feels good in the body, in the physiology. How can we get there? How can we create a sense of a holistic goodness? And that's not to say yogic practice is about feeling good, but it's a byproduct of the truth of our energetic cosmic conscious being, isn't it? Well, we get there through this energy, and we touched so much on what the energy in the body is. And now we bring it all together and talk about how it looks in the body, how you can create it and generate it. Really simple. Simon's holy grail, what he's seeking in creating the system that just works so easily. He talks a little bit in this part about the 12 bridges between the conscious and the subconscious mind, so the ways we can get in and out of our unconscious patterns, and hopefully in that process unravel those unhelpful patterns that we might be running on a daily basis, or maybe just irregularly. And then some beautiful quotes on nature and how it works by cooperation rather than competition, and what we can really get from posture and how that can lead to mental control in a way that is a loving sharing of energy and information rather than a top-down dominance, a holistic wellness. Anyway, I can't say it as well as Simon can. Lots of love in this conversation. I hope to catch you in the next podcast. Thanks so much for listening here. I hope you're comfortable for this one. Please enjoy. Let me know if you've got any questions. You can have a look at the resources on yogasteph.com/podcast. You've talked a lot about some really beautiful references to traditional texts, such as the Siddha Yoga texts, where you've started to tie in a few of these Western understandings with the Eastern purified expressions of it. And of course, there's a Sanskrit translation in between that as well. And you recommended the book Laya Yoga.
Beautiful book. Goswami.
Yeah, that's Goswami. I'll link that up with the podcast as well as the materials for your other stuff. But yeah, that's an incredible book because it seems to have so much juicy knowledge that points to a wisdom within us, which I've been really deep into, and it's blowing my mind open to really, it just feels right. But you also talked about Kalari Paya, which is a martial art where you started to reference or maybe just draw inspiration for the nine banda theory, which you use a lot in your work. And that also, I think, maybe came a little bit from Iyengar as well. And then I'm interested to know about how much of an inspiration it was, or how much of an intellectualized sort of study about the traditional energy. I'd love to hear from you a little bit on traditional energy, if it's something you feel called to share, and how you'd like to
traditional
share
energy in the body,
such as, you know, chakras, nadis.
Got it. Yes. Okay. So when we talk about the traditional idea of energy in, say, a yogic sense, we're talking about prana. When we're talking about it in China, we're talking about qi, and there's other words here and there, you know, which different cultures talk about. But this esoteric energy inside the body is expressed in many forms, and energy is interchangeable. So the energetic, you know, there's physical and there's energetic types of prana in the body, prana being like qi. So, for example, we can talk about energy-carrying molecules in the body, like glucose or fat, or even ATP, adenosine triphosphate, is an energy-carrying molecule in the body. Or we can talk about more energetic type energies in the body, such as heat energy, electrical energy, electrochemical energy, electromagnetic energy, magnetic energy inside the body. All of these we could talk about as types of prana. We could talk about the energy that's behind the nature of what's in oxygen and carbon dioxide. We could talk about the energy of the pressure of the blood and the gases inside our body. Pressure is force per unit of area, and force and energy are related as well, you know. So all of these things make the idea of energy inside the body seem different to one group of people, but actually it's all the same, really. And when we're talking about, say, chakra energy or energy and nadis, what is it actually? When you look at, say, the chakras, that we often hear that the chakras need to be opened. This is often a common expression. Chakras should be opened. And, you know,
like a can of worms.
Like a can of worms, exactly. I was always surprised that in certain parts of the world where they talked about chakras, like in Bali, for example, they would say the chakras have to be dissolved. I go, why would you want to dissolve your chakras? But the idea of dissolving them is the same as saying open them in a way, because you can think of a chakra as being like a main station on the railway line. So like when we have a railway line, say going through, you know, you're in the UK, so we have lots of railway in the UK, and we have Central Station, in which I think is in London, I presume, somewhere. And then you have also other major stations.
Well, maybe there's like four stations in London.
Right, okay. Yes, there's King's Cross.
They're all over the shop.
But you might have one big, you know, one big train station, which is the biggest train station in a country. Then you might have in other major cities, other main stations. So in a hypothetical country we'll call our body, the main train station will be the Kunda, or the core, or the Tanden, or the Dantien, depending on which culture you're talking about it, which is the enteric nervous system, right?
Beautiful analogy.
But then the other chakras, the main chakras in the spine, for example, Muladhara, Svadhisthana, Manipura, Anahata, Vishuddhi, Ajna, and the Sahasrara chakra, the crown chakra, they're all like other major city stations. And what we want is to have energy flowing through the body, going through the chakras, and we want the quickest transport of energy. So if you're going through a hypothetical country on a train, if the train stops at every station, it takes forever. What we want is a through train that does not stop at a station. And the thing is, if our chakras are blocked, the train will stop and maybe may not even get started again. But if the chakras are open, then the train goes straight through that station and it doesn't have to stop. It becomes a through train. So the idea of getting rid of the blockage of the chakra, or opening the chakra, or dissolving the chakra, is almost the same thing, if that makes sense. And
it's like a quicker through route.
Yes, a quicker through.
But it's also the scenic route as well.
We can also have a scenic route.
You know, you won't be seeing just stations.
Yes, yes. Now, the idea of how chakras and relate to the flow of energy throughout the body, and how they relate to the musculoskeletal system and the nervous system and the cardiovascular system and the respiratory system, relates to how I first understood what's happening in terms of the world of Bandha in Indian yoga. Because, you know, Bandha was something which I understood from childhood to be essentially what in the West we call a Mula maneuver or a Valsalva maneuver, where a Mula maneuver is essentially a breath retention, where an exhalation retention, where you blow out all of your air, you've got no air in your lungs, and then you make a mock or a false attempt at inhalation using the thoracic muscles or the inspiratory muscles of the thorax. So you're making essentially a pretend breath into the chest without inhaling and with the abdomen relaxed. So it looks like your abdomen gets sucked right in when you do this. Now, in modern times, this got very confused, because people confused with the interpretation of Uddiyana Bandha, that was called Uddiyana Bandha, with what Kepatabi Joyce was teaching in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about drawing the navel toward the spine. Mm-hmm. But that can be done either using a type of Mula Bandha or a type of Uddiyana Bandha. Mm. And what was not understood by most of the practitioners was bandhas, another name for them is lock. And a bandha can either be in the locked position or the unlocked position. And a bandha, if you study it, all the different forms of bandhas that we know about, they essentially are the co-activation or the simultaneous tensing of opposing muscle groups. When I say opposing muscle groups, say, for example, with your elbow, you have the muscles like the biceps, which bend the elbow, and muscles like the triceps, which straighten the elbow. So when you're using your biceps today to, say, do something like a chin-up exercise, the bicep switches on, and it makes the triceps switch off, so you can bend the elbow better. Otherwise, the triceps, if it's working, which is what it would do when you do something like a push-up, if that works to straighten the elbow while you're trying to bend the elbow, then you won't get a push-up or a chin-up. So generally in the body, we have a nervous system phenomenon, which says when you turn one muscle on, there is a nervous system signal, which tells the opposite muscle to turn off. And this is part of your autonomic nervous system, your reflex, your spinal reflex. There are several spinal reflexes, and they tend to be associated with your unconscious nervous system, the autonomic nervous system. But to a certain extent, you can override the unconscious nervous system by taking advantage of these reflexes. And what was something which was very arousing to me as a teenager was I remember seeing a picture of an Indian yogi or Tibetan yogi, I don't know, or some person sitting naked on a hill. And someone told me this person is meditating, they are doing yoga. And the words meditation and yoga became synonymous in my head. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. Because I saw this person essentially naked sitting in the snow. And at the time, I thought it was amazing. But around the same time, and I would have been in my mid-teens studying biology in high school, and I was reading about the nervous system. And it said the nervous system has two main parts, your autonomic nervous system and your somatic and your conscious nervous system. So they said the somatic nervous system can be controlled by the conscious mind, whereas the autonomic nervous system cannot be controlled by the conscious mind. Then in brackets, it said except by some Indian yogis. And I went, oh, wow, yeah. Who are these strange people who can control their unconscious?
Coincidence that those two sources were with you at a similar time.
Very early age in my life, in my teens. And I'd already been doing some yoga without knowing it was yoga in the form of breath retentions and bandha. But then I realized that actually this is a very special thing to be able to control the unconscious. So what does it take to access the unconscious? What is the real bridge between conscious and unconscious that allows you to, say, reprogram unconscious programs that we've been put in our bodies? You know, a lot of psychology revolves around fixing up people's past traumas, fixing up people's past bad habits. You know, like, for example, maybe something that was implanted into you when you're a teenager or in your, you know, early years before 10, where maybe a teacher or a parent saw you do something they perceived to be wrong, and they said, you're never going to amount to anything if that's the type of behavior you have. And all you heard was, you'll never amount to anything. And for the rest of your life, you've got this program which was placed into you at a very early age, which for the rest of your life, you think you're never going to amount to anything. And it's an unconscious program that really is not serving someone.
Yeah, lodged in the body.
So how do you get back into your unconscious to reprogram it? Well, this is part of my biggest exploration, because I love working with the physical body. I mean, you know, people constantly contact me to ask about how to fix their knees. And as an exercise-based physiotherapist, I love helping people's knees or their back. Wonderful. But I think I'm a lot better of a therapist if I can help people fix up their energy levels or their nervous system or their digestive or reproductive function or immune function, because nowadays immune function is the biggest thing in the world, really, isn't it? We're all talking about immunity in the world of this pseudo-pandemic situation that we're in now.
Showing that people are very nervous about their innate ability to regulate their own immune system, whether they call it that consciously or not, there is a great concern. I just want to reflect back about a little process that I went through while I was hearing you speak, and it was a delight at your linking together this, first of all, the idea of locks and unlocks, and that there is kind of like a locking mechanism in between the conscious and the subconscious mind through our conditioning. And that actually, when I was listening to you, I was thinking, oh, he's saying autonomic branches, where the inverse myotatic reflex, that responsive bicep tricep thing you were talking about, that's in the autonomic system. Ah, now my next question I was formulating as I was listening to you was, now Simon, would that be sympathetic or parasympathetic? And then I sort of dropped that question in my mind when I realized, wait, the magic of what he's sharing here is that there's an alchemy going on, and there's an awareness of being able to meet those two systems and to recognize perhaps where they're out of balance or in balance, and to reprogram those those habits, not just of movement patterns. It's like the spinal core stabilization thing we were talking about before. I was going to take it superficially and go, oh, is that autonomic process sympathetic or parasympathetic? And I was going to, you know, turn it into a duality. Whereas actually, I feel like the inspiration that you're sharing is you can actually go in there and reprogram your patterns of where sympathetic and parasympathetic meet. How does that reflection feel?
Yeah. No, it's very important. You know, we need to have a balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic. And, you know, the sympathetic winds us up and it excites us. Parasympathetic calms us down and depresses us. You need to be having that balance. So inhalation should create more sympathetic tone. Exhalation should create more parasympathetic tone on a very loose sense of what's going on. But what we want is not to think of them as being enemies. They're actually working together the whole time. Mm-hmm. And in a way, we could think of this as a duality, non-duality blend, mm-hmm. which allows us to recognize we're connected, but also recognize our sovereignty as individuals. And this would then help people on a psychological level as well. Mm. You see, what I was going to say before was that, you know, physiologically, there's a lot going on in our bodies when we do physical practices. And I was talking about, say, doing a biceps curl up, you know, a chin up or a push up.
Yeah.
So when we do a chin up, you're tightening the biceps, which will turn off the triceps via a nervous system mechanism. When you turn on the triceps by doing a push up, you will tighten the triceps and reciprocally release using a nervous system, autonomic nervous system reflex, that you'll turn off the biceps. But when you're doing this, you're doing something physical, which is affecting the nervous system, which is physiological on an unconscious level. But because you're consciously choosing to do it, you have an access.
So just to simplify that, you're saying you can access the mind layer, if you like.
Unconscious.
Through the physical body.
Yes.
Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly. And on another level, when you activate a muscle group, say, for example, the biceps, which bend the elbows, and you shorten the biceps as you would do as if you're doing the curl up, you know, from straight elbow, chin up to a bent elbow, chin up. The biceps becomes compressed and tense. And what that does is it pushes blood away from that region, while the reciprocally relaxed opposing muscle, the triceps, that will become lengthened and reciprocally relaxed through this autonomic nervous system, and that will cause a reduction in pressure in the area, which will pull blood to that area. So when you make the situation of one muscle group shortening and activating, and the opposing muscle group lengthening and releasing, you actually not only access the unconscious nervous system in a conscious way, but you also affect blood flow. And with that mm-hmm. blood flow, then there's also a transfer of information through the body. Now, once you start affecting the unconscious nervous system, you also play with the mind. Because if mm-hmm. you can tell your nervous system, say, for example, if you're feeling a little bit depressed and you give a little bit of sympathetic tone, that can get you out of a depression. And then if you're feeling a little bit stressed, you give a bit of parasympathetic tone, that can take you out of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, with time, you can use physical means to affect the physiology, which affects the mind then. Because someone who is under more sympathetic tone will be having this sense of an underlying state of flight or fight or freeze or whatever. And so the underlying subconscious emotions will be fear, anger, lack of safety, lack of trust. And that will affect the way they are in the world.
Yeah.
And so someone also...
And also you'll see that in their body as well.
You see that in their body language. And so someone who conversely has a more parasympathetic dominant tone will have as the dominant subconscious emotions, the emotions of love and peace and safety and trust. So you can choose then which part of the nervous system you're going to go into. But if I was dealing with one individual... And I could see, for example, that they tend to be just a depressive individual, I would use these tools, but I'd also use other tools like, for example, a very popular effector of the nervous system in the modern world today is what they sometimes call breath work. And breathwork can also affect the immune system. And breathwork often is associated not with the yogic type of pranayama, where the essence is to learn how to breathe as little as possible, but breathwork is often associated with hyperventilation. And hyperventilation is a very powerful tool that in the right hands can affect the nervous system in a positive way if you do it for the right person.
Yeah.
But in the wrong hands and in the wrong situation, it can cause a lot of stress because hyperventilation will blow off all your carbon dioxide, and the absence of carbon dioxide in your body causes an increase in the alkalinity of your body, which will cause a hypersensitivity of your nervous system. Now, if you're very, very stressed already, hypersensitizing the nerves can make you just more stressed, put you into a panic. But if you're very depressed or bored and you hypersensitize your nervous system, suddenly you feel your body. Maybe you've been living in your head and suddenly you're feeling your skin for the first time and you go, wow, I'm connected to my arms and my legs. Wow, I can feel something. Mm-hmm. And it becomes exciting, makes people giggle and laugh. But if you take them too far that direction, it becomes stress. So generally, I try not to use hyperventilation in a large group, because if you do use it, the ones who are already more stressed will actually have a negative response to the hyperventilation. And the ones who are less stressed or more depressive, they'll have a positive response. But what it does, the hyperventilation also will tend to take them right out of their brain to a certain extent. So they might become a little bit more in their body and a little bit more stimulated, but they're not going to think clearly.
Yeah. Out of their brain in what sense is that?
They become spaced out, right, essentially, you know, which is not a good thing to do.
Yeah. Not necessarily into the body.
Exactly. So I find playing with that pathway is a potentially dodgy one. So I would rather find a different way of working with people. And that would be a way where primarily I find the best result for large numbers of different types of people, heterogeneous groups, will be to give them an excitement in their life by moving blood through their body, by encouraging blood flow. And when you encourage blood flow in the body and people can feel, for example, that their fingers and their toes are almost the same temperature as their armpits, yet the ambient room temperature is quite cold, people tend to feel good. Their joints work a lot better. Their energy levels are better. So someone who, say, for example, walks outside in Canada in the middle of winter and everyone else is wearing jumpers and they're just wearing a t-shirt, someone might say to them, aren't you cold? And they go, no, I've got good circulation. It's a sign of health if you can have blood flowing very easily in your body, yet your heart rate is very, very low. Heart rate being very, very low is associated with the parasympathetic nervous system, but encouraging blood flow could be associated with sympathetic nervous system or maybe just associated with feeling good. And so again, I go back to this idea of, do we really need to look at parasympathetic, sympathetic balance, or do we just need to look at what makes people feel good and what keeps people healthy? And the healthiest people are the ones who remain really calm in stressful situations, but have lots of energy, which means really blood flows very effectively through their system, yet heart rate stays very low. They don't breathe very much at all. It's what fit people do. They run fast, have low heart rate, good circulation, less breathing, as opposed to sick people who have high heart rate, high breathing. They're not doing very much. And they, you know, often they finish their exercise. They're not doing very much, but their fingers and their toes are cold. So what I'm looking for in the practice that I give, using the physical body, using simple techniques of posture, movement, and simple breath control, as simple as just learning how to restore natural breathing, learning how to move from the core, breathe from the core, act from the core, learning how to unblock the blockages of loving information and good energy through the body, which I'll call parasympathetic dominance and good circulation with low heart rate, by tensing their body less, stretching their body less, breathing a lot less, and keeping heart rate low and not doing stressful things, but moving enough so that antagonist muscles, when they're contracting and shortening, will push blood from one region and opposite muscles will pull blood towards that region. This is simple active movement. But along with active movement, where you get this activity of the nervous system reflexes of what we call reciprocal relaxation. There are something you mentioned before, which is called the inverse myotatic reflex and the myotatic reflex. These are often known euphemistically as the stretch reflex and the anti-stretch reflex or relaxation reflexes. These three main reflexes, once you start to understand how you can use them in their body, then you start to access the nervous system. And one of the weirdest ways of accessing them is to find a way of tightening the shortened muscle, which will elicit a reciprocal spinal reflex, and also tensing the lengthened muscle at the same time, which will stimulate an inverse myotatic reflex. And when you start doing two opposing muscles tense at the same time, which in physiological circles we call co-activation, that is analogous to the state in Indian yoga that we call bandha. And when you realize that bandha, in all the different forms that people talk about it, in all the different forms of yoga where the word bandha is used, essentially it is a co-activation or simultaneous tensing of opposing muscles around a joint complex, often where one muscle is short and tight, the other one is long and tight, which if they were individually happening by themselves would be stimulating two types of spinal reflexes in a way that really modern science doesn't fully understand. And so somehow, when you do this, the ancient yogis somehow access their nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is special. And when I talk about accessing the unconscious mind in order to reprogram the unwanted programs that we might have inside ourselves, I use four main methods, if you like. One of them is to use the spinal reflexes and actually control body movements to access spinal reflexes, which might mean doing active movements or resisted movements or creating co-activation we call bandha. Another way is by using these movements to increase the circulation of blood through the body in a way which keeps heart rate low. And in my papers, I talk about 11 other ways to move blood through the body other than the heart. Mm-hmm. And if you can do this and get blood really flowing effectively, energy levels pick up, but heart rate stays low. Mm-hmm. So you get this parasympathetic, sympathetic seeming balance, you know. And then another way of accessing the unconscious is to use what I often refer to as 12 bridges between the conscious and the unconscious mind. And these are the places in the body which are unique in that they have dual control. They have conscious control and unconscious control. And the one that, you know, people often know most about is the diaphragm, because the diaphragm is something which you can consciously control. Most people can learn very simply to place one hand on the chest, one hand on the abdomen, keep your chest still, breathe into the abdomen so you feel your abdomen swell and soften, while the chest doesn't move. And then you know you've done a diaphragmatic activation, creating a diaphragmatic breath. But that which you can control consciously is also what happens when you're asleep, which means that you have conscious control over that muscle and unconscious control. You see, many of the other muscles, most other muscles in the body, will either have conscious control or unconscious control. So, for example, elbow muscles are purely under conscious control. But something like the muscles going around blood vessels, they're under unconscious control. You know, if I let my elbow sit still by itself, it's not going to suddenly bend unless I'm having some sort of cathartic attack.
Or you fall over.
Or I fall over and it stimulates a reflex like that. But in the normal passive state, it's not likely to bend by itself. It's mostly under conscious control. Mm-hmm. Whereas something like a blood vessel, which will also constrict or expand using the musculature around, say, an artery, we can't consciously shrink or expand an artery. But using other methods, indirect methods, such as by regulating breath, by hyperventilating or hypoventilating, you can affect blood vessel diameter. So there are certain secrets we can use to access the unconscious.
I think that'll blow people's mind if they realize you can actually, just like you can move your elbow, you can open your blood vessel. And that's something in your system that I've appreciated. You can do that.
Yes.
And actually, like, I think that's something really worth driving home is like, guys, you can give your heart a rest and you can let the circulation flow better, which is going to increase lymphatic flow as well. So the cleansing that moves through and is interconnected with the blood as well.
Cleansing, digestion, better reproductive ability. Mm. When we say reproductive system, it's not just about having better sex or having better fertility or less menorrhea or, you know, dysmenorrhea or amenorrhea, less premature ejaculation or less impotence. We're talking about the reproductive system as the regeneration system. So it means that when you're 80 years old, you'll reproduce new brain cells.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the reproductive system is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And so these parts of our body are the real source of our health, happiness, and longevity. And that's why it's really important that you maintain a dominance of the parasympathetic nervous system, because it's when the sympathetic nervous system dominates, you turn off immunity, digestion, and reproduction. So although we can have a little bit of sympathetic tone, and it's not even bad to let the sympathetic nervous system dominate for maybe 1 to 10% of your exercise time, but no more than 10% of your exercise time. And that's assuming that the rest of your life is not stressful. But if most of your life is stressful and you dedicate 100 minutes every day to exercise, if you spend any more than 10 minutes of that time where your heart rate has gone up, you may be doing negative things for your long-term health.
So this is the thing people don't appreciate. It's actually, maybe they just don't know their lifestyle is so stressful. They think that's the baseline. Yeah. They think that's normal.
Most people's lifetime is so stressful.
I remember taking a mindfulness-based stress reduction course like the Jon Kabat-Zinn meditation method. They showed us a chart, and the chart was, this is how your stimulation response comes on, and this is how it goes off. And it goes off very, very slowly.
Yep. Yep.
They showed us a chart where the stimulation response went up, and they said, when you're stimulated, because of all the cortisol, because of all the adrenaline, because of all this, it takes a long time for the system to come back into rest and digest. Whereas actually, it's a lot slower to get the parasympathetic nervous system in gear. So maybe it's that our, you know, our lifestyles, as you talked about, saber-tooth mortgages and children, that because of all those factors, that's why we'd really benefit from focusing in on the parasympathetic state in an otherwise sympathetic lifestyle.
That's why we can benefit from it, yeah. Is that what you said? That's why we can benefit with it.
Yeah. Just to clarify on your point there, and that people might not necessarily realize how stressful their lives are.
Exactly.
Until they've experienced space and freedom.
Exactly. And this is why, you know, I'm all for having athletic bodies and doing wonderful gymnastics and beautiful martial arts and beautiful dance. But what sort of lifestyle do you have, you know? And what age are you? Because, like, my daughter is doing beautiful circus arts. You know, she does flying trapeze and aerial silks. And she's 17 years old. And she's just, to me, she's like a super athlete. And when I was in my early 20s, I used to pride myself on doing 108 backward walkover, backward flipovers five and a half minutes. And that was such fun, you know. Yeah. But it's not something that I would do now. It would be quite difficult for me to do now. And really, most adults will probably find that if they do any exercise at all, it's better than nothing. But often if they do most of the exercise that's taught, it actually adds to the stress of their life. If exercise causes nothing but increased heart rate or stretch or tension in the body, there might be a mental benefit, but physically or physiologically, the body interprets all those things as stress. There might be some physiological benefits such as an increased blood flow, but that increased blood flow might not be then associated with better blood flow to the internal organs, because the internal organs at that time might be turned off. And if all you're doing, as many people would do, is just increase heart rate, but you're not even getting blood to your fingers and toes, which is what many people do. You know, they exercise for an hour and a half, heart rate goes up to the roof, but their fingers and toes are cold at the end of the practice. Then they haven't even improved blood flow. All they've done is tax their heart and stimulated sympathetic nervous system, flight, fight, freeze inside their body, and fear. You know, so this is what you don't want.
And I guess people won't know the benefit of that increased circulation until they've really felt it. Until they know it from within.
Everyone loves the feeling of feeling warm. It's like, you know, what I look for is that feeling of being in a warm bath, being massaged by someone who really loves you. So if you can do this to yourself, if you can make yourself feel warm through simple, safe, non-threatening movements, in a way that you feel warm and it's engaging and fun. It's like being in a warm bath, being massaged by someone who loves you. But if you're doing something which is just going to make your heart race and there's a feeling that if you're not careful, this particular exercise could kill you or could damage you permanently, this could be a problem. Not for everyone, because for some people, the only way you get them to come into the present moment is by doing something so terrifying that it puts their life on the line. You know, for many people, you've got this problem that they'll only come into the present moment if they think that it might be their last moment.
Well,
and when you put people so close to the edge of life and death, that for some people is the only way you can get them in the present moment. But it's a bit dodgy, you know? It's like that expression of, if it doesn't kill you, it'll make you stronger. But if it kills you, you sort of miss the point. You know? So many popular exercises are like this. They're potentially very risky. And it's okay-ish to be risky if you're 17 or 20 years old, because although you can hurt yourself, the chances of it happening are less likely than someone who's in their 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s. And also someone who's young who gets injured is more likely to heal. But the older you get, the chance of injury is much greater and the chance of recovery is also much less. So what we want as we get older is to be able to do less threatening things, things that are less likely to make like to make you feel like you're right on the edge of life and death, but are still engaging enough to excite you so that you feel stimulated, but safe enough and calm enough to keep you on that parasympathetic mode. You know, it's a very tricky balance. My eternal holy grail has been to try and find an exercise form or a pattern or something which I can teach, especially visually, which doesn't require too much mental stimulus, where people of all levels could do it and enjoy it. But it's really like chasing, you know, the wind, you know, if you like, because it's very difficult to give different people the same exercise and expect that they're all going to enjoy it. You know, I remember one time when I was training my students in India and I was teaching very lovely spinal movements that people loved. You know, this was about nearly 10 years ago. And my son was with me, and at the time he was like 7 years old. And I thought I'd encourage him, you know, because when he was younger, I used to do, you know, kids yoga classes with him up to about 5 years old. But when he was seven, he was already too grown up. And I said, come on, Eric, let's go out to the beach together. I didn't call it yoga. I said, let's do some stretching together. And he goes, why? Your stretching's not even stretching. In other words, to him, it was just so boring. There was nothing exciting about it at all. And you know, when I'm doing my simple movements, you know, it's way too slow for him. And he has a virtual reality game on his computer where things are firing at you and you've got your goggles on for 3D virtual reality and you have to hit with these virtual lightsabers in your hands. And I had a go and I got good and I could do one hit every second. Bum, and music plays at the same time. So the music's going bum, 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 and I'm able to hit every second. And I'm going, wow, this is really good. And my son said, I'll put my music on. And his music came on, and it was going, bup, 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 bup. And things were being firing at me, and you're supposed to hit them. And I had no way I could do this. He put them on, and he was able to respond to hit different objects in three-dimensional virtual space with his imaginary lightsabers at the rate of 8 every second. And so his mind and his reflexes are so much faster. And I remember we were following once BKS Iyengar in his ashram in his, you know, school, he called it, in India. And all the students were a bit scared because he was practicing and we were practicing our own practice in the same room. So no one wanted to show off the teacher. And so when he did a pose, we copied. When he changed pose, we changed pose. And it was going on for about half an hour. And eventually he stopped, got up, and he shouted at all of us, what are you all doing? You're all copying me, moving so slowly. He said, I am old. My blood moves slowly. You are young. Your blood moves fast. What are you trying to do? Stagnate yourself. In other words, we have to all go at our own pace. And really the best yoga, the best exercise has to be individually tailored. But then that means, how are you going to teach it to a large group? And this is why yoga was once taught individually, one-on-one.
Yeah.
The idea that you can teach it to a large group is difficult. Mm-hmm. And especially since large groups are so now twisted by the physical limitations of their lifestyle, things like sitting for 5 to 15 hours a day on chairs, you know, by limiting their physiology, by doing things like holding their navel to their spine, locking their core, pulling their shoulders back and down, which are things which are instructions which people have done just to compensate for their chair-based lifestyle and to compensate for often overeating and to look fashionably good. For a girl, for example, will not be comfortable letting her belly hang out, whereas actually it's more healthy to let the abdomen relax than it is to suck it in and hold it tight and inhibit the diaphragm for many people.
Yeah.
So that affects their physiology.
And the enteric nervous system.
Yeah, and enteric nervous system gets inhibited. And then on top of that, we have a mental state in the modern world, which is one of no, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, Darwinian pseudo-evolution theory, which is just theory, not fact, and, you know, survival of the fittest.
Reductionist as well.
Yes. It's this idea that no pain, no gain, you know, the idea that we have survival of the fittest, whereas really we know that nature works by cooperation, by symbiosis, by synergy, not by survival of the fittest so much. So actually, the Western paradigm is one which goes totally against yoga. So when you give people exercise, instead of doing things which feel delicious and nice and make them feel good, they do things which often cause physical problems in the joints, physiological ongoing stress to put them into a state of sympathetic dominance, and mental problems because they become competitive within themselves. And I often say that if someone is being competitive with another person, that might be fun. But once you start being competitive with yourself, I always say, well, it's going to be you against you, and one of you is going to be losing, and that's going to be you. So don't compete against yourself. Yeah, we're often doing
this. Compete against ourselves, so we're definitely a loser at some point.
Yes, you know. So this, unfortunately, really confounds the problems of how do you help people access the unconscious mind. You can't do it with just psychology. You need exercise. You need movement to really access the unconscious. You need simple, accessible, I call it accessible but effective, posture, movement, breathing, some mental control. And then you've got a chance of accessing the unconscious mind and really making a change in someone's personality to make them more accepting of themselves, to make them happier, to make them realize that happiness is a choice, not something you wait for. And then once they're happy within themselves and they're enjoying their life, they can connect with themselves and have a purpose in their life. And maybe that purpose might be to be a more productive member of society and help other people connect, help other people feel good about their lives. If everyone did this, I believe the world would be a better place. But it has to start within yourself. And unfortunately, I think the way people are trying to approach exercise therapies and relaxation and meditation therapies is there's a discontinuity. The exercise stuff gives limited benefits to blood flow but with stress, and the meditation and relaxation therapies tend to give limited benefits to relaxation without making blood flow. And what we really want is simple, accessible posture, movement, breathing, mental control, where you can get enhanced blood flow, which I'll call good energy, and loving information, which I'll call parasympathetic dominance. And when someone has good energy and loving information flowing through themselves and they can feel it being shared between all the cells, it just makes them have this really good internal feeling, which is health, happiness, and a sense of trust in themselves and a sense of love within themselves. And it just makes them want to share it with the first person they meet. Whereas if there's sympathetic dominance inside the body, then the subconscious emotions of fear, anger, aggression, lack of trust, lack of safety are within themselves. That's the message they pass out to the first person they meet after their exercise.
Mm.
If someone is depressed and just goes for relaxation, they're going to get more depressed.
Mm.
If someone is stressed and just goes for relaxation, they're just going to get apathetic and weak. We need something which bridges the two, which can help people who are stressed and depressed, or both, or either. We need something which is going to help people who are physically weak and no energy, and also the ones who are very, very strong as well. Something that can bridge all of it. And I believe that's something which is a meditative practice, which involves safe, accessible posture, movement and breathing, which can actually access the physical body to help the joints and the muscles get structural safety, health and functional ability in a pain-free way. And then also physiological health in terms of keeping that parasympathetic dominance with a bit of sympathetic tone still, that's going to help them feel that their immune, digestive, reproductive system works well, they have good blood flow, they feel unstressed, but they're still able to do things that are exciting, and they feel calm, but they're not bored, you know. And then at the same time, that is going to help their mental body to be in any situation. Once you can experience all of that, you can be in a situation in life which is stressful, but you're not fazed by it. You know, people often tell me, they go, how is it you don't get stressed? Mm. How is it you don't seem bored right now? How is it you don't seem stressed? Because I practice. I do practices in my life, which I call semi-stressful situations. I do in a controlled environment. I call it my yoga practice, but I practice being relaxed. And I do semi-boring situations in a controlled environment. People, I call it my yoga practice. It might be looking like meditation to someone, but I don't get bored. I'm finding ways of becoming engaged in those boring situations and calm in those stressful situations. And then when these things hit me, boredom or stress, or potential boredom or stress hits me in my life, I'm not bored. I'm not stressed. I have freedom.
Yeah, responsive.
Freedom to choose.
So we could say the practice is to choose to be happy, to choose to be relaxed.
Well, that's the ultimate ability that you get, the ability to choose happiness at any moment of your life and to recognize it's a choice. And in fact, you could do that regardless of how bad your physical body is. Mm-hmm. But if you can just find a way of making your physical body feel happy, pain-free, and your physiological body feel pain-free, then it's much easier to choose happiness on a mental level. But once you master it and recognize that happiness is purely a choice that the conscious mind can make at any moment, regardless of the stress around you, regardless of how unhealthy your physical or physiological bodies are, then you override everything else. But that's the advanced stage. The easiest way to feel happy is if you can make your perceived environment a nice one. So the perceived environment is different to the real environment. It's like a person who sees a snake, who was told by their mother that snakes are dangerous, as opposed to a person who sees a snake who's told by their mother, who was a herpetologist, that snakes are really nice. So the two situations have the same external environment, but the internal perception is different.
Yeah.
So our real environmental stimulus is not what we're actually seeing on the outside, but how our body interprets it.
The internal environment.
And so if you can change and if we can control our internal environment, we can also control our mind. So the first step is to control the physical body in a way that allows us to control our physiology and then make our physiology affect our mental body and then realize actually the mental body had the control in the first place.
Wow, Simon, thank you so much for these amazing insights and for glowing with inspiration. And we'll close now because you have another engagement, and I really appreciate you giving the time. And I'd love to go into a little more detail on a few things if we have the chance in the future.
Anytime. I'd love to. It's fascinating.
Namely, what you were saying about being one with the tree, and then you talked about energy, you know, you talked about heat and magnetism and carbon dioxide. You know, these are ways in which we are one with the tree on the energetic, the pranic level. Yeah. I'd love to go into a little more about that with you if we get the opportunity on the podcast again.
I'd love to talk more about all these things. It's fascinating talking with you. It's fascinating talking with you. Thank you very much.
Oh, that means so much, man. Thank you.
And thank you for being interesting in these things, and also to not worry about my history and my past and referring people to other blogs that I've done where I've talked about these things. It's more interesting to talk about what we've talked about.
It's so great to speak with you. I really appreciate you more than words could express, man. I'm so grateful for everything you do.
Thank you. And likewise, I really appreciate your support.
Thank you.
And encouragement and the wonderful work that you're doing, Stefan. Thank you very, very much.
Wishing you a wonderful day, Simon.
You too, brother. You too. Take care. Lots of love.
Thanks, man.
That was fun. Recognize that happiness is pure. purely a choice. Perceived environment is different to the real environment. Our real environment is not what we're actually seeing.
It's not what we're actually seeing. It's not what we're actually seeing.
On the outside.
On the outside.
But how our body interprets it.
But how our body interprets it. But how our body interprets it.
The easiest way to feel happy.
The easiest way to feel happy. The easiest way to feel happy. To feel happy.
Is if you can make your perceived environment.
Perceived environment.
A nice one. If everyone did this,
if everyone did this, if everyone did this,
I believe the world would be a better place. But it has to start within yourself.
But it has to start.